Perhaps I'll start with a bit of a caveat about the title. That title was a result of Nikki sending a note at some very odd hour of the night about that there was an abstract space that whether I was interested in filling it. And so in what happens at very odd hours of the morning, one then crafts titles that one hopes are sensationalist enough to be able to capture an audience. I do not know to what extent we succeeded, but also broad enough to allow one to talk about what one might want to talk about. And so what I really want to talk about here is how elites use norms and institutions, and in particular, how I think the Ugandan government, the elites within the Ugandan government, the political elites within the Ugandan government, used the International Criminal Court. So I'll do this in three steps. First is to talk about the current explanations of, a step back, to think about how the elites used the International Criminal Court is to interrogate the question that Lars Worldof raised yesterday, which is, to what extent can we say that the ICC was influential in the Juba peace process for Northern Uganda? So for those who are not familiar with that, I'm sure Uganda has been discussed at length in this conference enough that you must feel by now, you know, you've gandered out. But the question that I will be trying to assess is the extent to which we can talk about the ICC influencing the Juba process. And the way in which I come into that is by saying that you can understand that question by understanding how elites use international institutions to pursue different goals, and peace can be one of those outcomes. So going back to the three-step process, I'm going to give perhaps some current explanations of how it is that the ICC is thought to have influenced Juba. I'll then talk a little bit about some of the theoretical and scholarship, theoretical work, and some of the scholarship that thinks about how elites use norms as a way of understanding some of the shortcomings in the current explanations. I will then talk a little bit about some of the observations that I saw in Uganda. Now, another caveat here is that this is part of my DField work, so any landmines in the argument that I'm making, I encourage you to notice them and raise them to me. And any feedback is obviously very, very welcome. And perhaps this is a good point to outline my argument so that the take-home message is clear on the outset. So if you decide to run off for another session in the middle, at least you get the take-home message. And what I'd like to argue is that what I observed in Uganda is that there was an influence. The ICC was an influence in the Juba process, not in the way in which the norm promoters would have us believe. My argument is that the ICC was used by the Ugandan elite in two instances. The first instance as a weapon in the ongoing conflict, or what was then an ongoing conflict, with Sudan, to externalize the costs of the ongoing conflict in Sudan. And in the second instance, to do two things simultaneously: engage with the court in order to maintain its legitimacy as a state that adheres to its international obligations, and actually the stakeholders you interview will use that very language, but at the same time to disengage sufficiently with it to maintain its constituents to please the northern Ugandans that the government had to try to bring into the fold, and the army that was getting very worried about the implications of the peace process. So there is a simultaneous process of engagement and disengagement, and that might explain the vacillation that you see in how it is that Uganda engages with the court. At one point it's saying, oh, we really are supportive. At another point it's saying, actually, we do not want this instrument here. We need to move on with our traditional process. So that back and forth in my argument is one that we can understand if we think about what domestic politics were going on in Uganda at the time. So that's sort of the outline that I'm going to, you know, try to fill in. So then the overview of how it is that that the ICC is thought to have influenced the court. Yesterday, Lass raised a question, which is a very point blank question, which is, you know, Barney, tell us, did the ICC trigger it? And what Barney said, no, it did not trigger it. So triggering, we can put that to the side, that the ICC being the reason why this happened, why Juba happened, is an argument that does not have sufficient evidence. What we do have evidence for, however, that I will get to in a second, is that there was a role there. So there is an argument that I can present and lay to the side, which is the argument of those who say that there was absolutely no influence, that the court had absolutely no influence in the process. And that is the argument that, you know, in the first 15 to 20 minutes of talking to the spokesperson of the Ugandan army, he told me about the militarized, the strengthened military capacity and how Museveni had bought more armaments despite the international community urging him otherwise, and the manner in which the UPDF, which is the Ugandan army, was a lot stronger. Now, that argument very quickly, when you ask more incisive questions, fades away and they start acknowledging that, in fact, there were international normative pressures that led to the Juba process and that pushed the Juba process forward. Another argument that you hear in that camp of arguments that I'm going to lay to the side is one that lays this process exclusively in the hands of the geopolitical developments in the region at the time. And you heard this again in the presentations that my colleague Stephen here has made and the other people who have talked about Uganda in the last couple of days. And that is about the CPA and the changing, or perhaps the LRA becoming obsolete as a result of the comprehensive peace agreement being negotiated. That is obviously very important, but that is not mutually exclusive of ICC influence. It's an important factor that does not necessarily exclude that there was normative influence. So those arguments, once you push the people who are making those arguments further, and then you ask them such things as, why do we have agenda item number 3, which is exclusively about peace, justice, and accountability? Why is it that we do not have signing in the end, because the Kony is citing fear of the ICC, or perhaps not signing, not citing fear, but saying that the ICC is the reason he will not sign. Those kinds of observations cannot be answered by people who do not give the ICC any role. So I'd like to argue that in fact there was a role, but the question that is an interesting one is the kind of role that it was, right? And so the common explanations are very mixed about what they will tell you the role of the ICC was. I mean, you will hear a mixture of coercion and persuasion arguments, and most people will make this simultaneously. So the kinds of things you will hear are such arguments as soft power, that, you know, the ICC is persuasive, and so, you know, Museveni must have been persuaded to think about A, referral, but B, getting on the getting negotiations started. But an argument that is implicit in that is perhaps that the government cares about this discourse of victims that has been popularized by the ICC, and to stop further victimization, then it makes sense to negotiate in order to bring the conflict to an end. What you also hear a lot, especially from the human rights community, and I think this was clear in the presentation that our colleague from Human Rights Watch was making yesterday, is the normative weight of the ICC. But I think this is more of a coercion argument, because what they are really saying is that the rebel groups, for instance, are thinking, oh, we might be next. And so that is about incentives and disincentives. And when we think about it that way, that is really a coercion argument that they're giving us. And then there is what Akhavan calls the looming presence of the ICC. Again, that is about the ICC being a threat. And when you listen to Ocampo, he also talks a great deal about how it is that rebel groups and army generals everywhere are taking into account ICC, very much in a rational choice. You know, it's going to cost us more to continue down this particular path, we might as well change our pathway kind of ways. And there's a whole bunch of evidence they bring to bolster those positions. But one of the shortcoming of looking at this mixture of persuasion and coercion is that we don't understand, or we cannot understand, the back and forth that I have described on the outset and that you've heard described by the various people who've talked about Uganda. We cannot understand that move that Museveni has between compliance and non-compliance, between I will support the court, I will not support the court, between cooperation, non-cooperation, you know, I believe in justice, but no, I don't, I'm going to put in place an amnesty. That back and forth, that change in compliance that we observe cannot be explained by both the persuasion, or it cannot be explained by persuasion, because, you know, if I'm persuaded, I agree that the merits of your arguments are persuasive and therefore I act in a particular way, or by coercion, because my costs remain, I ought to be able to act in a particular way consistently. So the lack of consistency is one that perhaps theoretically hasn't been grappled with as much as one would like when one looks at the observations. But there is some scholarship which is really interesting that I wanted to cite very briefly. And that is the work that has been, well, I mean, first of all, the work that has been done by the people who do normative socialization, Rees and Sikink and others, does provide a little bit for thinking about this instrumental use of international norms and institutions, but it does so within the framework of the roadwork to socialization. In other words, Museveni can use the court all he wants to do, whatever he wants to do, pursuing war with Sudan, but ultimately, you know, the court is being legitimized, and therefore we are on the path to normative socialization, despite the fact that what we're observing is instrumental compliance. That, you know, that's interesting. It's assuming that everybody is actually going towards this part. It's assuming a straight line. It's quite a teleological assumption, and there's something problematic about that in social in observing the social world as a whole. But there is some work that has been done by Goodman and Jinks and a number of other scholars, and what they're talking about is acculturation. And the way in which they think about acculturation is where statesmen do what is being done, not because they care about it, not because it's going to solve the problems that they want to solve domestically, assuming they want to solve these problems, but they basically copy institutions that happen to be in supply. And so the way in which the transitional justice institutions have been put in supply is of the nature that one can, when one sees the way in which they're being adopted, could say that actually, perhaps what we're observing is acculturation, right? And what Goodman and Jinks are saying is that acculturation is something that states do because they want to get rid of, you know, a cognitive dissonance of being the odd ones out. And so what they get as a result of doing what everybody else is doing is an equivalent of a cognitive pat on the back, right? So they're not the odd guys out. But, you know, but one can argue there are very many other reasons why states can adopt. There are many other reasons why states can adopt institutions over and above this dissonance. Well, the work that is particularly fascinating for me, and this is where my work comes in, is the work that Subotic has done, Jelena Subotic, looking at former Yugoslavia, and what she talks about. And on the very, very first panel, when we had Lee Payne moderating, she mentioned a little bit some of this work. But what Jelena Subotic has worked on is what she calls the hijack of norms and institutions, where basically, it's not just about adopting what's in your neighborhood. It's actually thinking about what's in your neighborhood as a resource. So if you are facing political uncertainty and the ICTY can help remove that political uncertainty, you will use the ICTY to that end. If what you're worrying about is the politics of legitimacy, you will look at the international space around you and see which tools you can use for that purpose. And what I'd like to argue is that what I see happening in Uganda is the ICC acting as a resource, or becoming a resource for the Ugandan government, to use for, you know, its various goals. And so this is where my research comes in. And so then I'll tell you what I found in Uganda. What I found in Uganda was, you know, very similar to what Subotic is describing in former Yugoslavia, which is the court being used by the Ugandan government. And I'd like, what I observed was two moments of appropriation, and I'll call it appropriation for a whole range of reasons that, you know, in my work I do describe, but I'll just put the word out there. The first moment of appropriation is what I've already mentioned, which was the court was appropriated through the act of referral by the Ugandan government. And this was in order to externalize the costs with the ongoing war with Sudan. Sudan. So one of the people that I was interviewing, and my work is based on elite interviews, one of the people I was interviewing was describing Museveni and Garang. Garang is a former, the late leader of Southern Sudan, coming together and thinking about this as part of the military strategy that they have for Northern Uganda. And as Barney was saying yesterday, the assumption was in the beginning that actually you might get a Sudanese arrest warrant out of an LRA referral, which obviously was wrong. But the reason why this was possible takes us back to the work of James Ferguson and others who talked about the anti-politics machine. When Ferguson describes development work in Lesotho, he talks about the way in which particular international institutions have a capacity, particular international institutions and interventions have a capacity to drain politics out of very deeply political issues and render them technical. So when you look at the humanitarian, and Ferguson is describing the development enterprise, but his argument is one that has been used in different kinds of international interventions, including humanitarian intervention, and I think very applicable in the work of international justice interventions, international judicial interventions. The way in which that type of intervention discursively shapes what it's looking at is technical. It, you know, LRA's war crimes are not part of a political process. They are war crimes which need to be looked at in terms of gravity and applied due process. And there's a range of technical processes that you bring to bear that completely removes or perhaps deliberately keeps out the politics that generated the observation that one is working with. And that's just how these processes work. And what I'd like to propose here is that the Ugandan government, being savvy to this, having been a government that instrumentalizes interventions over time in its history, and Stephen and I, and my colleague Stephen and I have talked about this in the past, given the history of the Ugandan capacity to instrumentalize and to recognize how the international community works, this was a narrative that fitted very well within the Ugandan government's way of thinking about how the LRA ought to be presented. So the Ugandan government has always presented the LRA as apolitical, as, you know, crazy, and they don't have any political goal, and so on and so forth. So the narrative of the Ugandan government fitted very well with the way in which the international judicial intervention shapes the space in which it intervenes, i.e. the LRA as an apolitical object. And so it's this anti-politics that facilitates the first moment of appropriation of the ICC by the Ugandan government. And as I've explained, in this case, it's really an instrument of war. It's about the ongoing conflict with Sudan. So when we had a meeting in Kampala, and Kagoda, who is the permanent secretary, started talking about what needs to happen for the ICC to go away, what he said is that, well, what needs to happen is for us to ask the ICC to leave, the conditions that led us to bring the ICC in have to go away, i.e. the LRA, the ICC has to help us capture the LRA. But when the ICC helps you capture the LRA, they're bringing the insurgency and the the insurgency and the war to an end. So when you start thinking discursively about what's happening, what you realize is that everybody has bought into this exercise of the technical approach to what it is that the technical way of looking at the ICC, in a manner that they've completely forgotten that what they're talking about is a war. And if it's a war, if you bring the rebel group you're fighting to court, you end the war. And so the way in which the ICC is used in this way, I think, is an interesting one, in that we need to be very cognizant of, because we empower various constituencies and disempower others, depending on perhaps our awareness of this phenomenon. The second argument, really quickly, notice that I have no time, so I'll just quickly mention it, is that unlike the actors that Ferguson describes in Lesotho, the actors in northern Uganda actually grasp or perhaps reclaim their agency. They do not allow this anti-political maneuvering to remove their agency completely or to water down their agency completely. And some of Agrawal's critiques of Ferguson's work have been that, are you saying that all these people who have been acted upon internationally have no agency? Do they not act? And what I'd like to argue is that in Northern Uganda, what you do have is action from the Northern Ugandans in the form of the roads going to New York and to The Hague to tell people, well, look, but in Northern Uganda, we don't think of things this way. We think of justice differently. And my colleagues have talked about the way in which this happened. And in so doing, this politics that was being drained out by the original approach by the Ugandan government was brought back into this process. And that's when the opportunity for peacemaking became available, because three things became apparent to the Ugandan government. Number one, Teddy, what became apparent was that the reintroduction of the ICC, of the politics back into the process, meant that the clear-cut way in which the ICC was going to work was not sure anymore, because these people who had introduced back the conversation of politics were also introducing back UPDF potential culpability, i.e. the government of Uganda could no longer dictate the terms of what was going on, right? The second thing that became apparent, and with that, if the government of Uganda couldn't dictate what was going on, it also means that the army becomes very uncomfortable, and that's the most important constituency of the Ugandan government. So the government has to think very critically about how to engage with the court in these circumstances. The second thing is what my colleagues mentioned as well about the constituency in Northern Uganda that has always thought of the government as being anti them. With the reintroduction of politics into the situation, then the government saw an opportunity to engage and gain brownie points with Northern Uganda. And the third thing is, follows Jan Egeland going to the north and talking about it being a humanitarian crisis and there being pressure on the Ugandan government with regard to dealing with the crisis in the north. And therefore, there were three important elements that were reintroduced with the politics when the Northern Ugandans took agency. And at that point, the second moment of instrumentalization became possible, because then the ICC could be used as a stick to egg forward this process. What I'd like to find in my next trip out there is how it is that this discourse of the ICC works when we move on to the exercise of Operation Lightning Thunder, for example, when the government washes its hand clean of this peace process and starts a military strategy. Are we still seeing the ICC being used as perhaps some of the discourse that is justifying what the militarization strategy? It will be very interesting to find that out. What I'd, my concluding remarks are that we have to be. What am I arguing? What I'm arguing is that when we start saying that the ICC can contribute to peace, look at Uganda, we have to be very cautious about what we're talking about. The scope conditions of the Juba peace process are very, very particular. This is not a universal, court comes in, peace process comes out the other end. No, there's a lot of politics that is ongoing here, some of it very unknowable politics, that one of the side outcomes is this peace process. But this wasn't a planned peace process. This was political contingencies and various political maneuverings leading to an outcome, which is then being celebrated as a potential outcome of a deliberate process. And I think that is one of the cautions that I'd like to urge and that my work is preliminarily pointing to. The second question, obviously, the second point that my work is pointing to is, obviously, transferability being one, but teleology, the assumption that you can, start at one point and end in another wonderful straight line. I think we have to start problematizing that. But going back to the panel title, power, actors, and agency, what I hope this work starts to point to is that the kind of actors we look at have to go beyond the transnational actors, the NGOs who are, putting out their idealistic perspectives of what it is that ought to be happening. And we have to start thinking about how this is actually working in a domestic political situation. Who are the people who are acting? How are they acting? Who is starting the process? And what are the interests here? And this is something that Ruti talked about in her panel a little bit, that we have to be very cautious about the issues of actors, and today as well. Wendy talked about it. And power, we have to think about how it is that the court becomes a resource. It becomes something that people use to project themselves against others, against others. So we have to be able to take that into account. And the final thing is, the court being involved, the discourse of the court and its moral weight has the capacity to both empower particular sets of agents, but also to disempower particular sets of agents. So when you go into the North with particular definitions of what justice needs to contain, if the Northerners sit back, then that becomes the hegemonic discourse. What you see in the North is that they do not sit back. They do actually start asking, you know, what does it mean? What do these things mean for us? And so perhaps in this case, the kind of disempowerment that is possible isn't quite realized, but one can start to see how it is that particular ways of understanding the world become the dominant way of doing things, and various alternatives become muted. And then after, you know, the final thing, the final point where I'll stop is, I have trouble with the argument that Mamdani has made recently about the ICC and its impinging on sovereignty. I think that particular argument, and I obviously have no time to get into it at all, that argument has a very particular view of what agency is. And in this case, the African heads of state, the African elite actors, are being seen as disempowered people who are on the receiving end. But I think what my work is pointing to is that there is very much a vibrant agency that is appropriating these institutions and using them very strategically for good and bad ends. And some of these ends, I'd like to argue, could actually be subverting of the principles and institutions that we're trying to advance in the first place. So, yeah, thank you.